Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is Dan Weatherspoon, your host, and this is our second one this week. After we finished the episode on blacks and the priesthood statement, the new statement by the church on race, it just dawned on me, and a part of this was watching the conversation not only on the Mormon Matters blog, but on Facebook groups and just in the general bloggernacle, that there's a lot of folks who are coming right now to really have to face, perhaps for the first time, or else it was moved off the back burner to the front burner, this whole question of what is a prophet? If prophets can be this wrong in terms of, you know, reading God's will or reading the truth about people of all races, you know, if they can sort of, you know, still not escape the environment that they're in, the thinking that they're immersed in and things like that, then what is a prophet? What is a prophet good for? How are they different than just the other people? It seems like scholars and thinkers are a bit more ahead of the curve than prophets, and all sorts of things like that seem to be coming up. Sometimes it's going to be for people for the first time who go to the Salt Lake Tribune or the different newspaper sites that are reporting on this, and they're going to be confronting it for the first time. I think within these communities, it's sort of been their back burner issue and stuff like that. So I just thought I would gather a couple of friends for a little bit different of a Mormon Matters podcast. We're not going to deal so much theoretical, dive deep, as I wanted to just kind of go through the personal journeys of the three of us that we have today on sort of making that transition, that probably 10, 12 year long, who knows how long. I know it took me at least quite a long time to sort of kind of go through, I don't know if you want to call it Fowler stage 4, you know, or something along this issue of prophets, revelation, scripture. For me, was a big piece of my journey towards a different kind of view. And so I thought it would just be fun to have a personal stories on this question of reframing prophets and things. So, I know everyone's going to celebrate this. We have not had her in a long time, but Joanna Brooks is with us again.
Oh, hi, guys.
Yes.
I'm yes, here.
You've been quiet for a while, Joanna.
Oh, you know, 2012 took some recovering from. You know, I had to come home. I had to come home and do the dishes. So,
yes.
And, you know, sometimes you have to be quiet to have something good to say. So I'm not sure I have anything good to say yet, but I'm really glad to be back with you all. And thank you, Dan, for inviting me. I just love Dan. And the whole Mormon Matters audience. So thank you for having me.
Well, thanks. And I think everyone knows you a little bit, but a quick,
you're
at San Diego State. And tell us a little bit about
you. I wrote a book called The Book of Mormon Girl, which was published last year, Memoir of an American Faith, about being a searching human Mormon. And I'm a senior correspondent at an online magazine called Religion Dispatches. And I'm also proudly a permablogger at Feminist Mormon Housewives, which is one of the longest running and most important blogs in the blogger now.
Is that a new thing to be
a perma? They let me join them as a perma about a year ago or
okay.
So.
I just
and I'm
just, noticed.
I just love them. And if I can just plug the blog this week, we have a piece up right now. We've linked to by Janann Graham, who's a African American Mormon theologian and scholar, and we're really trying at FMH to use this moment as one where as black women and white women in the church can turn and start talking to each other.
Awesome. Yeah.
And so please visit that site and join that important conversation. Let's listen to our black sisters in this moment.
Yeah, awesome. And Janann was on my podcast that I released on Monday about the new race statement.
Yeah, your listeners know she's remarkable. Yeah.
Rhonda Callister, welcome back to Mormon Matters. We're thrilled to have you. You're at Utah State. Tell us more.
I've been on the faculty at Utah State University for 16 years. I'm in my 17th year. I'm in the field of organizational behavior. My research covers anger and conflict management, mediation, and gender. Yeah, I spent several years working on a large NSF grant trying to change Utah State University so we did a better job of recruiting, advancing, and retaining women in STEM, science, technology, math, and education.
Awesome, awesome.
I also did that Sunstone article that you edited that some people have read on For Better, For Worse, For Apostasy about faith.
Question mark, yeah. For yeah. Apostasy? Yeah, that's how I have to say it in my head to make it make sense. But yeah, it was so great. You and your husband, Mike, kind of going through just the different faith journey at different times with each other. Yeah, that was
And along with two other couples.
Right. Well, it's so great to have you back. I love your perspectives. Now, what I thought we'd do today, you guys, as I mentioned, is let's just do personal journeys. I'm sure that the blacks and the race and the priesthood statement will be on our brains, and as we tell our stories and whatnot, we'll certainly make connections here. But I really did want this podcast to be less about theoretical issues and far more about personal journey. And so let me just kind of start this off with asking, we'll just do a round of each of us kind of sharing something about the earliest stages in our Mormon journeys where we kind of said, oh man, I really have to rethink this. You know, what I was raised with, what, you know, kind of assumed just growing up through high school, through seminary, institute, whatever it is, this is no longer tracking for me in my own experience. And so I thought we'd just kind of share a little bit about the earliest stirrings of, wow, it's time to face some things in a new way and hopefully find clarity. So love to have Joanna kind of give us a rolling start.
That sounds great. And thanks, Dan. I like this personal approach. And I just want to say that the long arc of my comments is probably going to be about how I came to shift from worrying about the question of prophetic infallibility to really just sort of trying to focus on what continuing revelation is, what that looks like, and what role each of us plays in it. Because shifting my thinking in that way is like the story in a nutshell. But you know, I remember being, it was fourth grade for me, and it was during the ERA controversy, and President Kimball came to speak at the Rose Bowl in Southern California, and as a good Southern California Mormon girl, I was probably 8 or 9, and I was so excited, and Kimball was the prophet of my childhood, and I had tremendous affection for him, and for his person, and for his voice, and so I was so excited to see him in the Rose Bowl. And that year at school, I was doing two term papers in my fourth grade class. One was on the Equal Rights Amendment, and one was on Joseph Smith. We had to do a term paper on a prophet. So I'd spent this time sort of researching the life of Joseph Smith and trying to translate this historical character, you know, figure, this prophet, this founder, this restoration founder that I cared about so much with what I could say in a school term paper. And dealing with his humanity, you know, trying to say why he was such a great leader to sort of a secular audience, aka my fourth grade teacher. And then the next semester, I did my term paper on the Equal Rights Amendment, which was bubbling around me and which I sort of liked in theory as a 9-year-old girl. This all kind of came together. I was sitting in the Rose Bowl. There's President Kimball, you know, and then the plane started flying overhead, the Mormons for ERA plane with Heavenly Mother Loves the ERA. And, you know, it all sort of came together in this moment that, you know, I did not dislike the plane. I did not dislike the plane, and yet I loved President Kimball. And I felt at home in that moment of tension. It was okay. It was interesting, you know. And and so, you know, that's the early moment at which my coming to be at home in tension between stirrings forward and respect for the leaders of my faith started.
How deep did you go then? I mean,
oh, not that deep.
Yeah. So I'm just gonna say
deep enough for a fourth grader.
Yeah, no kidding. So that's what I'm saying. Was there a period then of being back in a bubble or whatnot before you said, oh, okay, I really got to roll up my sleeves?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I had puberty to deal with after that, which was enough. But I think the other state, I mean, really, I'll save the next step for the next question you ask, because a lot of the rest of it happened at BYU, of course. But I think it might also be important to just kind of say that my family background is all like really working class Mormons and only one pioneer line. And so in my pioneer line, we were not like, we were sent other places. You know, we were not noble, connected people. So, you know, I one thing I've observed and that I know that I did not grow up with was a sense of like, oh, I have access to the general authorities and that makes me important. And that's something I still think happens a lot in LDS communities and sort of contributes to the way we deify prophets. And we can go into that later. But let's just say I was always part of sort of the regular rank and file Mormon people. And, you know, that was sort of, I think, allowed me to see things differently.
Awesome. Well, thank you. That'll be great background to pick up on as we go more into the actual struggle itself. Rhonda, tell us a little bit about you. What age did you first start thinking of this and really like, I've got some work to do here?
Well, I think I probably came to it a little bit later because as an oldest child, I just grew up believing and trusting authority. And so, but in junior high, the questions of race started. So I was in junior high from what, 69, 70-ish. And questions of race were pretty common. I was challenged at school. Oh, Mormons are the ones that don't like blacks. By seminary, we were discussing it and we were getting all of the rationalizations why the blacks didn't have the priesthood. And it wasn't sitting well, but I still stayed within my Mormon boundaries of not questioning too much and trusting authority. In fact, I was in high school during the Vietnam War, and there were significant protests at my high school. We had a mock election. McGovern won by a landslide. So you know kind of what the political leaning of the school was. So there were protests. And I kept saying, why don't they trust authority? Why are they questioning the government? I just didn't quite get the questioning process because I just came, just something in me was very obedient and trusting. And it took me a little longer to begin to actually open the questions I had. And we'll get to that. But I think it took encountering personal pain before I could really go more deeply.
Okay, and do you want to share any piece of that right now, or you just want to wait for, like, when you decided to dive in, was it all at once? So in other words, should we save it for
it
the
was
next
two,
section?
It was two sections, so I can go into the first one now. And that really didn't come, my dive into questioning really didn't come until I was finishing my master's degree and expecting my second child and trying to decide, the classic case of Mormon women, trying to decide what to do next. Should I stay at home with my children? How could I continue to continue learning? How could I continue making a broader contribution outside my home? And it became painful when I started saying, but what kind of guidance could Heavenly Mother offer me? And is eternity just having babies for all of eternity? And that sounds really
right,
awful.
Right.
Really awful. And so I just had this deep, deep longing to want to know more about Heavenly Mother and who was she and what was she. And that's where it became painful. But where I was in my little suburban community of young mothers just like me, I couldn't find anybody that asked the questions. And so I was just left with no place to go. I know there were women in the church asking those questions. But this was right the year after Sonia Johnson's excommunication. And there was no one that would talk. There was no one that would talk about it. And so I just hit it at a moment where the conversation wasn't happening.
Okay, awesome.
And had to set it aside because I couldn't find anything and kind of piece together my life as best I could.
Thank you. So wonderful. You know, my story, I've told it off and on in bits and pieces here, and, you know, I didn't have anything early on because the Mormonism was working so good for me. I was, you know, the star of all my, you know, priesthood quorums and growing up, and I, you know, was smart, and I had parents that would ask me questions all the time, and so I kind of learned to frame my own ideas and answers, and so I was just like, felt like I was this rising star within Mormonism, you know, fast track, of course, to the upper echelons, you know, bishop by 25 or whoever, whoever knew what was going to go on there. And then, of course, you know, I just proved to myself that I was just riding a dream. I just was, I hadn't done any real work. This was sort of natural talent and just kind of riding up the current of things. And so, of course, then kind of for me, it was, you know, partying and beginning to just sort of cross every line and every boundary that, of course, I would never fall and stuff like that. And so by the time I hit time for a mission and stuff like that, I'm you know, got a fake ID and I'm going to the clubs all the time and all those kinds of different things. And I just don't even, but again, I wasn't questioning Mormonism. I was just rebelling against the idea of growing up and taking adult responsibility and things like that. So, you know, even after, you know, my, you know, processes of sort of, you know, hitting that rock bottom, and I'll even share an experience later in the podcast about one of those things that really got my attention. But, you know, after that, I got myself ready. I went on a mission. I was an awesome missionary. I was, you know, I apply at the MTC, and within, you know, 3 days, I have 3 job offers, you know, kind of thing. And I'm teaching at the MTC for 2.5 years, and I'm riding the wave, and I'm studying philosophy at BYU, and I studied Latin and Greek. And I kind of got a little bit into mythology, and I kind of began to see a little bit that how truth can work in these non-literal ways. But, you know, Joanna, you were probably there in English, so you at least had heard the term postmodernism. If I had heard it, it was only like in art or something like that. I never really kind of wrestled with this whole perspectival nature of everyone's experience. And so I just, you know, I escaped BYU basically thinking that, you know, it was possible that, you know, we get clear messages from God, and especially if I'm not getting them, you know, prophets certainly are, or the scriptures certainly represent those things. And so it wasn't for me until grad school. I'm 29 years old when I'm, you know, going to Arizona State in religious studies, and I'm finally having to confront for the first time, you know, what seems to be really strong, strong evidence, you know, and I mean, now it's just like, how could I have ever seen it any other way? Because it's so obvious. But just the human touch on scripture. And so I'm looking at scripture, and I'm just saying, wow, this guy's got an agenda, or here's two different voices that are telling the story, but they're telling it different. Or anyway, I just, whatever sense of privileging scripture became very, very difficult for me. And I had it in a big, big way through a fellow who's a very famous New Testament scholar named Burton Mack. He had come to Arizona State once a week. I think it was a Thursday night. He would fly in, teach a class, and then fly out Thursday night. Claremont School of Theology. He was at Claremont. They had this deal where they were trying to get a lot of people to study theology and whatnot locally, and they had picked the greater Phoenix area. And so he would come in to do this, and I took his first class. And the thing about him is he is completely like, let's just look at the New Testament as if it was through social forces and whatnot that shaped it. And, you know, Mark, the one who wrote the first gospel, let's look at him as the linchpin, and then let's look at Q and the sources, and he just basically did all that stuff. But he was so delightful as he did it. It was like, here's Grandpa, you know, here's Santa Claus basically serving me up stuff that just was totally challenging me. But one of the neat things that he did in his class that I think maybe got me to a position where I have to really think through this myself, is he would play this game called Gotcha, you know, G-O-T-C-H-A. And what it was, you know, in some ways I think it threw off some people, especially early on, but whenever somebody would give an answer, or when they would talk about the text that we were working on or something, and if it was something that was clearly coming from the things that they brought to the text, the theories that they had, something that's not in the text themselves, he would say, gotcha, and he would teach us to do it. We as a class weren't quite as, you know, ready to say gotcha to our fellow classmates, because they would say it to us and things like that. And so I don't know that the game really got going really good, but he did it in such a wonderful way that, you know, gotcha, he would play gotcha on himself, or he would tell his own story. So it really wasn't like this big trauma, but it was so clear through this process of how much what I brought How much would I expect it? How much I had privileged the New Testament was what we were dealing with. Oh, and I had studied Greek, New Testament Greek when I was at BYU. So I at least knew a little bit that translation, you know, was this all over the map thing. It's not this precise science. So I'd gotten at least a feel for that. But here it was clear that I was bringing so much, and we all bring so much to text, that that's where I finally had to kind of do it. And so I'm talking about scripture here rather than prophets, but in some ways it's they're two pieces of the same puzzle for me. Because if scriptures were written by prophets, or at least people that we feel like God has inspired, and they're still this major evidence of human fallibility, human expectations, you know, desire to make yourself look good, to spin things this way, you know, to justify wrongs or whatever it is that's in there. And if that's in there, you know, that does affect later when I started to really wrestle with LDS scripture and LDS prophets. So that would be my earliest stuff. Anybody want to comment on any of each other's early stuff, or should we move on to kind of the wrestle itself?
Dan, I just want to say one thing is that I came through BYU much like you did, kind of unscathed in my critical thinking, especially going through the business school at BYU. There wasn't a lot of challenge to that, you know, think more deeply, question things. And so it wasn't until later in life, a little bit later in life, much like you, that I began to question for myself.
Yeah, cool. Joanna, I mean, unscathed for you, or again, you were just your head of the curve?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think education in each of our stories is playing a pivotal role, you know, and I came up through BYU as a humanities major, of course, and that put me in the heart of great liberal arts tradition of questioning, and I got that at BYU. I got it in, you know, honors colloquium with, you know, people like, you know, Professor, Gardner. Whoa, what's his name? I forget now. I had a physicist, a psychologist, and an English professor. You know, I had wonderful people like Hal Miller, who was dean of the Honors College, Eloise Bell, and Gloria Cronin, and some were a little bit more open. But, you know, many I could just sort of by being with them and being in a place of discerning, you know, pick up that, look, Mormonism was complicated, you know. That it's okay for it to be complicated. And I would sort of look at these esteemed figures and, you know, people of knowledge and learning, people of science, and say, well, do they think that Joseph Smith was infallible, that polygamy was intended, and the Book of Mormon came directly from the mouth of God and, you know, the hand of the Nephites? Or do they have a more complicated take on things? And so I sort of matured with these role models around me of this, you know, quiet living of complexity. And there was a beautiful dignity in that. And it was very impressive. But at the same time, there were, of course, when I was at BYU, these, you know, larger institutional and political forces and tremendous backlash against feminists. And it all sort of culminated in, you know, my senior year when Boyd K. Packer gave his now famous, you know, speech about the three enemies. Mm-hmm. And here's a man who we would sustain as a prophet, seer, and revelator, basically. And he saying that I was an enemy on two counts and that people I loved were enemies. And I knew right away he didn't know me. He didn't know my heart. He didn't know me at all, you know. And it was just so wrong. It was just so clearly wrong, you know. We talk about radical self-respect right now, Mormon feminism, but it was something even different. That was just dignity. It was just reality. Like, okay, he's doing what he needs to do, but he does not know me. And he does not want me in this church. And that's not what God wants. And that's not right, you know. So there were, again, different tensions pulling different ways that really made the possibility of thinking of prophets as human beings more live.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did you, like, so was there any moment where you said, okay, I've really got to confront this? Take us right into the heart of your battle reframe.
I don't know if there was a moment where I had to confront this. I think, you know, Dan, something you said earlier was interesting for me. I think I've always been in the peanut gallery, right? There was never any question that I would be a general authority, no matter how gifted I was, because I'm a woman, right? No matter how gifted I was in my priesthood quorums, like, I was never going to be a prophet, ever. Duh. You know? And, you know, there are young men who, you know, not being presumptuously privileged, but just benefiting from male privilege, look at the people at the pulpit during general conference and are encouraged to identify with them and aspire to be them. And that was never possible for me. Never. you know, so as always sort of being in the peanut gallery, I always understood I had a different place in this story and a different place in this equation. And so dealing with prophetic infallibility for me has, you know, always been a matter of just staking out a survival strategy as someone who's sort of always quietly lived with tensions or out loud lived with tensions. And B, coming to claim with greater openness and dignity a place for people like me in the great ongoing saga of what continuing revelation means, which, you know, I've come to mature into a view of it as an ongoing dialogue between God and a people. You know, it's an ongoing dialogue between God and a people. And the prophet is the guy who the institution designates to be the telephone holder, you know?
Right.
But it's a big, so reorienting the whole thing from this vertical view where there's God up in the clouds passing the word down to the prophet who passes it to the rest of us, to this horizontal thing where there's the people screwing around on earth and there's God and we're fumbling our way towards some kind of a conversation with God and the prophet is holding the phone institutionally. I mean, we each have access to God in this conversation, but right. The prophet holds the phone for the corporation, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that reorientation, I think, just really started happening over the years as a matter of survival, you know, I mean, and as a matter, and I think I gained an advantage in that by virtue of the fact that I never aspired to climb the ladder because it was never, ever open to me.
Right.
Not even by influence, like not even by this thing, like, you know, still Mormon liberals do this, and I'll get off my soapbox in 30 seconds, but still Mormon liberals do this. Well, this issue is going to be fixed because so-and-so knows, you know, President so-and-so's cousin or wife, and I can have lunch and with him and help him see what needs to be done. You know, I can't, I don't know anybody in the hierarchy. I never have, like that's all inside baseball. We are all so obsessed on the role of, you know, church leaders in determining the future of our faith. Anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. That we contribute to our own, even as progressives and liberals speaking as one, we contribute to our own, you know, fixation with prophetic authority by, you know, thinking of doctrinal questions as things that need to be resolved by getting to so-and-so in the hierarchy who can fix this for us. No, not my mind.
Very interesting. The nice thing is you did, you know, you didn't identify with prophets and things like that, but you had Gail Houston, you had Cecilia, you had this sort of, you were at Student Review, you kind of connected with the wider thing. And so perhaps, you know, today that's pretty rare and pretty interesting that you, the people you admired and respected were all around you already, and you had that sense of complexity already being there. So was there still any sense of, damn it, I wish it was clearer? You know, tell me about those emotions.
What do you mean, I wish it was clearer?
Well, that God really did break through the human, you know, filter, the layers of all the things that we bring. And I guess I'm just trying to get a sense of, you know, you were energized during this whole time, whereas I was like devastated and ate, you know, kind of thing.
Oh, you sweet thing. Well, you know, I think what you said about postmodernism is really interesting. I think for me, a large part of it was trying to, you know, just square, like, the more I got educated too, I realized how small our Mormon world was, you know, and just if our account was really as total as we presumed it to be, it just required, you know, refusing to acknowledge most of human history, you know?
Wow, yeah.
I mean, and it just couldn't be. It just couldn't be, you know, and that took a lot of time to know how to process that. And I actually think, you know, some reading in a different body of philosophy helped, you know, thinking about, I love Hegel and, you know, Hegel talks about, and Hegel and after him, everyone who followed him, this whole tradition of sort of leftist philosophers just talk about the spirit. And Hegel was a theologian, but the spirit moving through history.
Right.
And
the
so,
dialectic.
Yeah. And coming to just love that, coming to love the fact that, you know, we're in a historical church, that we're part of human history, that, you know, there's a huge, huge God at work and that we are so small. That felt safer to me than being at the mercy of Boyd K. Backer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who didn't like me plainly and didn't want me in. You know, and I say that with love and respect for him as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, but the record stands, you know. Who am I safer with? Where am I safer? You know, I'm not safe in a world where prophets are infallible.
Or so fallible.
I mean, oh yeah, where prophets are infallible. I'm not safe.
Oh,
in
you're not
world
safe.
I see.
If that's the
I'm
view.
Not safe in that world. That world is not healthy for me. It doesn't like me. So as a matter of just survival, it just felt better to be out in the world, in the lone and dreary world, seeking God in the random pieces that I was able to access. And that's so that was disappointing, was feeling like home is not home. Home is not safe. That was the hard part.
Thank you for sharing that. And we'll pick it up from there definitely in a second. I want to hear from Rhonda. Rhonda, you had these stirrings. We got you to that point. When did you like say, this is time to really get to work?
Well, it actually started not with faith and religion, but when I became overwhelmed with life. After my fourth child was born, a few months later, Mike quit his job and started medical school. And it wasn't until after he was in school that I realized four children was as much as I could handle, and I couldn't do it all and couldn't do it all well, and began kind of beating myself up in terms of I need to do this, I ought to do this, and started spiraling down into depression. Saw a counselor who recommended cognitive behavioral therapy, and I'm a reader, and I just picked up the book and started reading, found what I needed, and began reprocessing how I viewed the world, how I talked to myself. And I had to take responsibility for my own feelings and well-being before I was able to, or before I was even open to the possibility of examining my religious questions. So I got to this point feeling really good and wanting to reach out, and I attended a pivotal Sunstone session. I wasn't quite ready to jump into Sunstone, so I only went to the Pillars of My Faith session and listened to Kathleen Flake tell her story. And on the way home, I got this inspiration. It just came to me. It said, it's time for you to open up your religious questions so you'll be able to answer your questions for your daughter. Daughters, I have four daughters. And that's what started it.
And tell us more about when you got into that wrestle.
Okay, so I then said, okay, so I started reading. I've told this story before, but I started reading, and I didn't know where to start until just like a month later, there was an ad in the paper for Carolyn Pearson's Mother Web of the Morning. I said, we have to go to this. We went, and she included in her program her list of sources. So that was my reading list.
Oh,
nice. Beginning of my reading list for the next year, and then sources from those sources. And I just basically read a lot of feminist theology for a year. I wasn't in pain when I started. I'd worked through my depression, and I just said, okay, this is time. This is the next step. And after 9 or 10 months of reading, I just kind of looked at myself and said, I feel like I have my entire belief system scattered on the floor around me. I have questioned everything, and I no longer have any idea what I believe. And I went, this is a little bit of a, I wasn't frightened, I wasn't upset, I was just saying, this is a strange feeling because I'm not sure where it's going to end up, but now's the time to start putting it back together again. And most of it came back together, but I just tossed a few things. I tossed trying to make myself believe that I would ever have to practice polygamy in the future. I just said, I'm not going there. I don't think it's going to happen. If it does, I'll deal with it when it comes, but I'm just tossing that one for now. So I put my belief system back together again in a way that was not dramatically different than what it was before, but it was all my choice. This is what I choose to believe. This is how I'm going to structure my belief system. And it felt really good. And I think it's what Fowler called developing an executive ego, but
right.
I refer to it as beginning to speak in terms of I believe instead of we believe.
Interesting.
So, and you can hear it as people talk, where they're coming from. Do they own their beliefs, or are they still saying, what we believe, and assuming everyone in the room believes the same way they do. So this was really, really significant, but I didn't realize it at the time because I felt very similar. I just jettisoned a few things that were painful and didn't sit right with me. But I now owned my own belief system. Then, a few years later, my husband began going through his faith transition. And his was much broader, and he was reading much more broadly, science, DNA, Book of Mormon. And as I went through that with him and began discussing it with him, I would say, oh, well, I don't believe that. And he goes, you can't do that. You're cherry picking. You can't just do that. And I said, yes, I can. And I'm fine with it. But it took him a while longer till he got to that point that he found that he needed to do the same thing, to fully own his own belief system. Just that classic Fowler moving into that stage four and deep into the stage four where you say, I believe. I have my own executive ego that this, and I think it's a critical part of the process where prophets are entitled to their, are responsible for receiving revelation for the church, but we are responsible for confirming that for ourselves and deciding. And the risk of not going through that process of deciding makes us really vulnerable to blind obedience and not being able, and we have to answer for our own actions, even if we're following a leader. Do we follow them in the wrong way? Do we go down the wrong path? And, you know, the extreme example is the Nazis that followed their leaders and the Nuremberg trials. Who was responsible? Was it the leader that ordered the atrocities and the genocide, or were they the people who actually executed the individuals and committed the genocide? And it's both of us are responsible. We have to own our responsibility for our own beliefs. We can't take everything a prophet says on blind faith. It's part of our responsibility to decide and to pray about it, to feel, does it fit right in our own life? And for me, one of the markers I use is, you know, does it inspire me? Does it bring out my compassion? Does it help me help others? And that's what I think ultimately is the value of love and compassion in my life and in the world, and what brings that out in me, as I use as one of my markers, and listening and listening to conference and deciding how I'm going to respond to it and what I'm going to do differently.
Thank you very much. What you're talking about here is, the thing is, and I guess part of the reason for wanting to share is, none of this is fun. You know, Joanna, as you're going through yours, Rhonda, as you're going through yours, this isn't fun. It sounded like neither of you were super traumatized by it. You just sort of took a deep breath and said, okay, here's life. It's far more complex serving up this. And I want to hear, you know, your positive explanations at the end of just like, this is worth the trouble to go through this. I guess my story is going to be a little bit maybe more dramatic, and maybe it's because of what you said, Joanna, with male privilege and you know, I've got the world by a string, and, you know, it's a man's world. I can conquer it all. So even after, you know, I come back from my mission and, you know, I'm successfully being recruited for CES, they wanted to hire me, and it was only my own, you know, choosing against that and whatnot that just said, you know, I've got to wrestle with this other stuff more. So I go in, and like I say, I still thought that going into my master's program and stuff that I would be, you know, just confirming what I already knew. I did not expect at all that I would, you know, be anything beyond, you know, eventually, you know, guy that teaches at BYU Education Week or whatnot, because of course the gospel was going to prove itself. And so with scripture as that opening foray, I began to really just have to say, wow, if it's happened there, it's happening now. What is going on? And this is the first time I really started to take a look around. And what you guys haven't said, let me just say, I had to grieve. There was a... maybe it was just, you know, I'm the king of the world. And I had bought into the whole pre-existence stuff, and that I was valiant in the pre-existence, and therefore I was born into a worthy family, you know, a family born under the covenant, and I have been given these gifts, and I've been placed in this position. In some ways, for me, it was like, I have won the lottery here. Not that it was really a lottery, because it was, you know, it was by my own, you know, valiancy or whatever, I'd gotten to this position where I didn't have to go through the same struggles that everybody else had to do it, because, you know, I'm just riding the curve of being in the true church and those kinds of things. And so you can't say that you grieve overnight, but I recognized really, like, going, oh my heck, it's complex for me too? Come on, this isn't fair, you know? And it was just, it was a, you know, that was just a sort of this background sorrow and real just crap. You know, I guess, you know, my earlier reference or my earlier rebellion against the church was, I don't want to grow up. I don't want to face grown-up responsibilities. Here I had to do it again, you know, and this time with my spiritual life.
But I just want to, can
oh,
we,
go ahead, please.
Can I, so, yeah, I mean, this is what we're all experiencing in this historical moment collectively as Mormon people. You know, we love being Mormons because we have been part of something remarkable, remarkable. And the question is, can we be special and wrong at the same time?
Yeah. Yep.
Does God's That's love right. extend to us even if we're wrong? And, you know, all those times you were wrong when you were out struggling and searching and, you know, having your Mormon bounce and clubbing and drinking. And I had those times too. Did God still love us in those moments? Yes. And did God still love us when we were segregating, you know, our priesthood and temple ordinances? You know, that's the question we now face. So again, this is about reorienting from, like, you know, prophetic infallibility to a question, can a people be wrong and yet still be trying to work it out in a special relationship with God?
Awesome.
I just agree with Joanna. I didn't necessarily grow up feeling quite as blessed, and it may be like Joanna that I wasn't male, I wasn't looking for, and I wasn't connected. I was not in the with Mormon hierarchy. But yes, that is, no, I'm just stop here. I'll let you go on. I'm done, Dave.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Well, let me just add a piece. I want to make an analogy. This will be kind of part of the struggle for me to where now I can, you know, honor a prophet. I can honor the scriptures again and things like this. And so let me just, I've got to tell you two spiritual experiences. I don't think I've ever shared them other than with friends, close friends before. But I don't know, that's kind of the reason that I felt as soon as I finished the other podcast that I needed to do this one. So I've just got to tell a couple of experiences that I've had to reframe myself, or at least life has led me to reframe. And maybe in some ways it's analogous to, I think, what's happened with the church and what I think happens with prophetic revelation, where anyway, let me just tell a couple stories. I'm gonna risk this for a second. When I was so falling apart, I couldn't control myself. I couldn't, you know, avoid, you know, spending $125 every week to get that gram of cocaine to have my weekend be good. And I was going into debt. I was bouncing checks left and right. Everything was going crazy. I dropped out of school, but I wouldn't officially drop out of school, so I was going to take incomplete. So, well, I was actually going to take whatever was worse than incompletes, because I was screwing up left and right. I couldn't make a good choice for myself, and it was a moment where I was really, really mad at my mom. She was kind of on my case about this. And so the typical thing, what do when you hate yourself? You lash out. And so I said some of the most horrible things that you can imagine saying to your mom. And it's out of my own pain and things like that. But of course, it was very painful to her. And at that moment, I had a voice come strongly within me, and it was basically laughter, and it was what I interpreted as Satan. And he's laughing at me, and he says, "I got you, Weatherspoon. All along you thought you're in control, you thought you're running things like this, but I got you, I own you, dude. You could not make a good choice for yourself if you tried." And it was so powerful and so strong, and it scared the living crap out of me, but it also, I couldn't deny it. And what that led to was weeks and weeks of depression and basically a determination that I was going to kill myself, because he was right. There was no way that I could pull myself out of this. And then, of course, within weeks, that was when the aunt and uncle invited me to live with them, and I kind of got out of patterns and situations, and luckily just, you know, being in a different environment where I wasn't with the same people, I was able to start to, you know, have, oh, I can make a good choice for myself here and there. And, you know, again, 6 months, 8 months later, as I'm, you know, living with them and things like this, I read the Book of Mormon, the Sons of Messiah, all that kind of stuff just, you know, made their change for me. And you know, so that was one story, though. But then, so interestingly, as I'm at the MTC and I'm rereading my patriarchal blessing, I didn't get my patriarchal blessing till, you know, a few months before my mission. And I'm reading this one section, and it says, God has given you these experiences. And basically, you know, the context was, however I was reading it that day, it was, what? All this life experience, all this crud of falling apart and partying and rejecting and da-da-da, God gave me this experience? And I just, like, it just stopped me in the middle of reading, and then the next thing I know, I'm, like, floating above the bed. I'm just, like, I'm in this, like, amazing cloud of, like, hitting me insight, like, boom, boom, boom. And the way my language came out of that insight, that moment of being taught something, was that in the pre-earth life, I did the same thing. In other words, I was a strong kind of leader type person or whatnot, and that at some point or other, I joined forces with Satan, that I felt like that was the way to go. We don't need this risk of life and you know, all those different things there. Let's be safe. Let's do this. And so the whole idea was that, you know, that I had done this and that this was my pattern and I was playing it out again here in this life. And I needed to sort of lose my agency and sort of lose my sense of, you know, the value of that before I could really appreciate it. And so, I mean, I'm kind of like praying after I'm getting this. I'm going, is this right? Is this true? Is this like absolute, you know, insight? And man, I was floating, and it just, you know, it affected me for weeks that I just had this sure knowledge of, you know, this was a blessing from God because I needed to play out that pattern again in this life. Now, 10 years later, or whatever it would be, you know, after that, you know, in my own study, in my own wrestle with things like this, I began to really doubt the existence of Satan. I began to really look at the whole war in heaven piece as a mythology, as a, you know, a story that obviously teaches wonderful truths, and that's how I teach it now. I, you know, nobody in my Sunday school class or whatever would ever know that I've, you know, kind of deconstructed these things, but those things became less and less, you know, sure to me. So, but what do I do with these amazing life transformative experiences that gave me a lot of peace and things like that when they came out of a framing? And I guess this is what I'm just trying to say. I have a feeling this is kind of what goes on, you know, with even with this whole, we're wrong. We have stories that we've inherited, and truth can come through those stories, and, you know, they can break through and whatnot. But yet, it doesn't mean that the story and the details of the story are true themselves. And so, I guess this is my way of saying I can see how prophets, I mean, I look at the at Genesis, you know, just the nature of the cosmology, that the earth is a flat disk that's sitting on these waters below, that there's the pillars of the earth, there's this firmament, this thin plastic film or whatever that embeds all the stars, and there's the windows of heaven and the waters above, and of course, you know, the flood can happen and things like when it's in that world, but is there still something that can break through and work with us wherever we are? And that's the case that I'm feeling here. So my own process of working through those stories to where they still are powerfully insightful, but the insights came through stories that I no longer hold quite as literally, that to me has been a big secret for me moving into looking at prophets and scripture and revelation today. So that's what I wanted to share today.
Wow.
That's helped me.
Wow, that's epic. That's epic. And I think, Dan, it just speaks to, you know, how do we regard the people we were when we were literal believers? Are we mad at ourselves for having been literal believers and for having to shift to? And I think some of us feel embarrassed, and I think some of us feel angry and misled and betrayed. And some of us have reasons to, especially over things like, you know, we were raised to believe racism. That has disfigured us. It is not good for us. It has stunted us. It has prevented us from understanding God. But, you know, so what do we do with that? And how do we, what do we do with the fact that we no longer believe as we once did? Can we regard it all with love and charity and understanding along the way? Can we forgive ourselves? Can we forgive those who mistaught us?
That's absolutely the key, isn't it? Thank you for that.
Yeah, and that was a beautiful story. I'm so glad that you shared it. It's so valuable to learn from other people's experiences. And that is a question that has to be asked as we go through faith transitions, is what do I do with my experiences that don't match my current worldview? And the best we can say is we learn from them. We learn from them regardless of how well they match, and we integrate it into our new selves.
Thank you. Joanne, I know you have to leave us pretty soon. I'd love to move to a third and final section of, you know, you've done this work, you've reoriented, you've, you know, I know you did leave the church for a little bit in terms of not, you know, having your name removed, but disassociating and then coming back and stuff like that.
I was less active and wild. Yes,
true. Tell us.
I had a Rumspringa.
There you go. There you go. Tell us why it was worth the journey. You know, share anything like that to encourage folks.
I think it comes back to sort of, you know, integrating all the parts of ourselves and accepting and loving who we have been and who our church has been. And you know, I was never not Mormon. I just it's just shaped every part of me. Mm-hmm. And it has been such a joyful process of being with you and with others who are working to make our home place even bigger. You know, just like, can we be wrong and still be part of something special? You know, because I think Mormonism, for better or worse, is one of the most remarkable developments in American religious history. It's very special. And it's wrong sometimes, you know, can it be freeing to say that? I've just found it very freeing to say that, freeing of myself, freeing in that allows me to love others. You know, and we still were afraid to say those things in public, Dan, even 5 years ago. I mean, I think everyone in the Mormon Matters community, you know, in the Blogger.cl should just really honor this moment in history that our struggles are part of a broader turning of our faith towards being able to say we were wrong and we are still loved and we are still special, you know, and again, that just goes to this idea of horizontality I've come to you know, grown a bit, where it's not God calling the prophet to issue an order to the troops. It's this dialogue between the people in all of our messiness and God, and the prophet's holding the phone. And there's a lot of complicated dynamics in there. Holding the phone for the institution, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of complicated dynamics, but it all belongs to this history that's unfolding that we have a special place in. And I don't want to give that place up. You know, my life is richer with it. So that's how I'm holding on. That's why it's worth it. I like being special and wrong at the same time. It's okay.
Yep.
Can now, you be loved and wrong, right? Yes, you
absolutely,
can.
Absolutely. Oh, well, thank you for being with us again. I know it's just our listeners are going to be going crazy. So fun.
Well,
thank you.
Much love to everybody.
I appreciate it too, Joanne. I've missed your voice when you've been recovering from last year.
Thank you all.
Well, I need to invite you more too, so it was partly my fault too. So thank you.
Oh, it's good. It's a pleasure. All right, take care, everybody.
Thank you so much. Take care. Goodbye. Rhonda, it's just you and me. I want to hear your place of peace now. And, you know, it was worth the struggle that, you know, how is Mormonism alive for you? How are prophets and you know, being okay within an institution that, you know, can get things wrong. How does that still worth it for you?
Well, first of all, I place really high value on my difficult experiences. They are what developed me, changed me. I kind of see the world in a developmental psychology kind of perspective, and I can see each difficult experience helping me become a better person. And so I'm grateful for those challenges that I encountered, both personal and religious. And I now look at the world, look at church leaders and recognize that they have to work with the organization they lead. And this organization has this wide gamut of philosophical perspectives, from very conservative to progressive to ultra-liberal to barely still in the church, and for a variety of reasons. And they've got to work within that. And there was something I read that Fowler once said, is that all communication from God comes through the individual's perception, cultural background, degree of understanding. And so all inspiration we get is typically at our level of understanding, or we process at our own level of understanding, because that's all we have to work with. And church leaders have to manage that for this whole range of philosophies. So, mm-hmm. for example, when the church rescinded the ban on priesthood for blacks, there was almost universal joy in that reaction. We didn't hear a lot of anger. We didn't have a major schism. But they'd had to wait until that point where they could do it in a way that didn't cause a mass exodus from the church. They had to wait for we as a people to get to that point where it was, oh, finally, yes.
Now I agree that that's a piece of it. So can I play devil's advocate here? You can get back to totally, spinning your own story here. So I agree that that's the case. And boy, if you read the Ed Kimball piece about President Kimball, that was clearly a worry of his. And he was also worried about the brethren, though, too. So in some ways, you're sort of saying they understand at a higher level and they choose not to because of where this wide diversity of people are. Are you sure that they all seeing at the high level? Are you kind of giving them
no,
that?
No.
I think there's somewhere a dynamic.
I think there's some in the quorum that are representing the conservative views. They've got a wide gamut within that group, and many things have to be unanimous among the quorum, but that's a marker of can the church as a whole accept it. If they can get the 12 to accept it, maybe, because there's very often a progressive, there are very often several conservatives, but you've got a male representative of the gamut of the church. You don't necessarily have a female representation, but you do have, and that something similar happened under David O. McKay that Greg Prince documents in his biography, that David O. McKay prayed about blacks in the priesthood, and more than once, and the final time the answer was no and not in your time. And I think, and I don't remember if it was in the book or Greg Prince speculating that Harold B. Lee was one that could not have accepted it and he had to wait until after Harold B. Lee in order, because can you imagine what would have happened if a couple of the apostles had created the schism and said I can't accept it or threatened to leave? It could have really fractured and damaged the church.
Well, that helps me understand what you meant. It's the leaders themselves that are all over the gamut, and that's actually a good thing for you in the sense of...
And that's representing the body of the church
and
their ability to accept transition.
Awesome.
And I expect the same thing will happen with gender issues and LGBT issues, that you can't make a major shift unless the body of the church has shifted. So I'm thrilled with the conversations that are going on and the recognition that there's unrest and pain out there, but we have a long way to go before the majority of women even can in the church can see priesthood as a possibility. It's not going to happen in the very near future. There's a lot that could happen in the near future in terms of greater respect and greater involvement in women in decision making. Mm-hmm. But I don't expect to see priesthood in the near future.
I hadn't planned to ask this, but it's coming up for me as you're talking. What about the critique that we'll often hear? Well, shouldn't prophets be the vanguard? Shouldn't they be the leading edge rather than the other? It sounds like a little bit what you've just said, as well as I'm guessing something about your organizational behavior studies and background and understanding, is that that's not the only way to lead?
Right. I see an important moral dilemma as... do you address the needs of the one or the few or the needs of the many? And And how do you resolve that dilemma, which leaders have to face in many situations? And one way is to say, okay, when the damage to the few becomes so severe or life-threatening, you may have to lean towards the few, but in most time you lean towards the needs of many. And that's what a leader has to do in making some of those decisions. And so, yes, we among the LGBT community, we're getting some suicides, and it's tragic, but would we lose vast numbers of members in pain and suffering if we tried to make a dramatic change without building up to that and transitioning the acceptance of the whole body?
And some would claim that even one life lost like this would be worth it. And, you know, so we don't want to sound like we're cold, hard utilitarians here, but...
Exactly. But can we address those individuals? Can we change their families and their parents? Can we begin that transition to try and keep them safe? Because that's who can have the biggest impact, is when the family's accepting, that's when you have well-adjusted children.
Yeah. One follow-up. What if the leadership, you know, again, that has to manage all this is also partly to blame for keeping people in, I don't know, the box or in the bubble or sort of giving a message of we can't lead you astray, stay safe with us. In some ways, they're keeping people in that parent-child relationship when, you know, we should be moving on to adult relationships with God, as well as with, you know, with leaders and you know, those that influence us around us. So I guess I'm totally sympathetic, but also I want to.
Right.
You're not letting them off the hook in terms of infantilizing members of the church. Yeah.
I don't. I see the statement that we can't lead you astray as problematic. I think that's their intention, but I think there's always the risk there, and I believe that individuals have to be making some of their own decisions and getting their own promptings and revelation on what to follow. Mm-hmm. That we have to retain our own morality, but look to them for guidance, because they're looking at a bigger picture than we're typically looking at in assessing our own lives.
Yeah, and I like that. You know, I like the idea that it's general conference. They're general authorities. There is sort of this, you know, they have responsibility for general, and that we have to own, like, you know, I love the executive ego and all the different stuff that you talk about in that transition to where we are in charge of our own lives, and we're the primary filter for whether something feels good or wrong and things like that. So I love all that stuff. I kind of interrupted your narrative here. So you, here you are, you're happy that you've stayed. You're happy that you did the work, all that kind of stuff. Any more, you know, just along the lines of, there's the great John Stuart Mill quote, it's better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. And I don't want to, a human being, a true human being satisfied rather than a fool satisfied. There's that sort of sense of, you know, it was fun to be a child. It was fun to be innocent. It was fun to have all that stuff. But yet, even though there's no clear resolution, there's no absolute final, I'm at peace with the whole world again here. Why is that better still?
I love the complexity at this point in time. I love wrestling in the gray areas. I mean, now that I'm okay with the gray areas, I love the interesting questions that I can say, oh, what do I think about that? I find it fun to be in this point where any new issue that comes up, I can say, oh, okay, this is my chance to work with and explore and ponder this particular issue because I haven't thought about this one in this way yet. So that's what I see as the positive, is that it's not cut and dry, it's not black and white, and it's fun that way.
Okay, is it fun at church? on Sunday?
Okay, at church, what I like to do, and I'm attending a student wing now, so I can hold back a little bit, but but I'd like to figure out the question for that lesson. What is the question? And ask it in a way that I can make other people wrestle with it. So even if
this
I
is how you
have,
this is how you lead, or is this how you as
right,
a class member?
As a class member, just especially if the lesson starts to go in a very predictable pattern, I try and see if I can come up with what is the interesting question that other people might engage. And my goal is to see how many comments I can generate.
Nice.
and as other people try and engage. So we're not doing this, here's a question, here's the right answer, kind of getting bored and
right.
everybody getting bored. But so, and I try and be really careful sometimes in Relief Society because some of the teachers aren't quite as confident and try and like come back and make a final comment so I can tie something together a little bit so I'm not leaving the teacher hanging, not knowing what
I
to
see.
Do with it.
Yeah.
But it's just, I think that this stage for me is enjoying and finding challenging, wrestling with some of the questions for myself.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Sunday thing, you know, I'm often bored too. I do what you do. I try to work myself into it. Generally successful when I do it. Sometimes I just can't find a way in at all. You know,
right,
it's gone
right,
so haywire
right.
and you feel like you'd be directly confronting a person
right,
versus just
right.
like, here's the wider perspective. And so it doesn't always happen. But, you know, I would also add the layer, and I'm sure this happens with you too, if they still teach me so many things that I just don't see myself. There's a beauty in this
yeah.
love and the simplicity of service. And I don't mean simplicity in terms of simple-minded. I just mean it's like there's this clear sense of this person in their heart wants nothing but good for others. And
yeah,
even if they're accidentally making a statement that narrows or hurts or wounds, it's not out of that. It's not out of anything. They just haven't examined it yet.
Right. And sharing personal experiences, when we can get to that level, we can all learn from each other's experiences because we've all experienced different things in life. And so it can be a bonding time if we can get to that level as opposed to just quoting other people or
right.
scriptures.
Right. Yeah, it's fun to see them come alive even a little bit when it comes to our direction. And then I just, you know, I'd say at least every month or two, God, just somebody just touches my heart in this huge way. And I'm just going, okay, get the ego out of the way again because you still have a long ways to go, Witherspoon, you know. So I'm just grateful for that. Hey, I let me go ahead and I have a thought on prophets that I just wanted to kind of share. Obviously, here I'm doing this podcast, people probably have gotten a feel from me that I think it's worth it. I especially think it's worth it if this is the religion of your birth, of your family, of your connections and things. I think our gospel is huge. There, you know, despite what happens on Sunday or despite the rhetoric that seems narrow and it doesn't address, you know, the richness and the depth, that Mormonism is there. And so I live there in my own heart and mind. And so, you know, rather than just the statements that kind of come and that seem to be directed just at the center of the church. So that's helpful for me that I love Mormonism. And so if it's worth it, you know, it's worth it to me, and I would hope it'd be worth it to other people to kind of stay and do the wrestle. If not, it's still worth it to do these kinds of moves into what, you know, Rhonda and I are pretty comfortable with calling it Fowler Stage 4 kinds of things. This shift from other people's authorities, other people's insights, oh, they're older and wiser, they've probably wrestled with this and figured it out. I'll just skip the wrestling part and just kind of go along with them. Any of that kind of stuff. I doubt very many of our listeners in this audience have chosen that, but there's an attraction to it, to just kind of say, this complexity isn't for me. So it's worth to do that, and the snark and the sort of, you know, I understand the expressions of cynicism and just sort of like scornful laughter of, well, this blows the prophets out of the water with their claims this, and I understand the need to sort of explode that way, but that isn't a good peaceful final position. And so I would hope that those who are wrestling on the heels of, you know, this Blacks in the Priesthood statement, whether you're coming to it for the first time or later, and you've got those feelings of like, you know, you just gotta throw out the snark and whatnot and just kind of laugh at how everybody's so naive and dumb and da da da. And I think partly that might be a little bit, you know, laughing at ourselves for how could, you know, hitting ourselves in the head, you know, how could I be this idiotically too that I didn't see it before now? But I would just, no matter what, go for peace. And the peace is there. In the middle of my wrestle, Rhonda, I don't know if this was the case for you. I found friends. I've shared with people that Randy Paul was a pivotal person that came onto me after my first year at Arizona State. And this is where I was again addressing scripture and beginning to address the things. And, you know, he just had that sense of calm about him that like he'd been there. Absolutely. You know, he offered some perspectives. It was clear that he delighted still in thinking within Mormon stories and different categories and, you know, the narrative structures and all that stuff. And yet he wasn't at all afraid or defensive when I would like throw my pain at him or whatnot. So I would hope that everybody would find somebody like that in their life. Just pray for it. Who knows if it'll come. Maybe you're already finding it through online things. Maybe you're finding it through different podcasts and different voices. But again, know you're not alone and know that there's plenty of people that can handle all the crap that you could throw at them and still be loving it backwards is such an important thing. And then the same thing for me too. You know, Rhonda, I would say it took me from 1989... late 88 to probably 99, maybe even 2000 before I kind of had made it through the hump, you know, to where I'm more like my center of gravity is more in this peaceful, you know, place of embracing it all. I felt the spirit a lot during this. You know, I would hit on something that would be a framing and I would get excited about it and then it would prove itself to, you know, every framing has its limits, you know, and so I'd have to move on to something else and I was up and I was down and things like this. But I never felt, and it sounded like you didn't too, you said you were at peace with it. You never felt like you weren't on a good journey, right?
Right.
Yeah. And that's what I would hope that everyone would do here. Now, your family may not think you're on a good journey. You know, those that you share it out loud with, you may scare the living heck out of them. And I remember, you know, it's like, you know, I used to be able to testify and now I can't testify. So for somebody on the outside, guess what? That looks like a loss. You know, and yet for me, I knew it was on the road to a deeper kind of grounding, one that won't be thrown by vicissitudes and, you know, human things thrown at me or, you know, the occasional bad leader. And it doesn't mean that I'm immune from the pain of all those kinds of things, but there's just this there's this sense of, I think, the universe and God or whatever it would be is letting you know you're on the human journey.
And let me just confirm a couple of things you said. One was finding people to talk to. It can be challenging because a high percentage of people around you may not understand what you're talking about at all. But when you can find those, even hearing a comment in church someplace or hearing somebody online that you know, if you can talk to them, bounce ideas off, it can make such a difference. What they have come up with may not work for you, but it gives you another way of thinking about it, and you can move and you can continue to ask those questions. And sometimes the way somebody else frames something can be a powerful way of putting the pieces together. A more complex, a different twist, a way of integrating that can be really useful. And the other thing you said that I really agree with and want to affirm is stay with it, because it can be so painful at first that you think the only way to get out of the pain is to leave.
Right.
But if you can stay with it, and you may have to take a break in order to, and some people do, in order to finish processing in a way that's not quite so painful. But if you stay with trying to put it your own belief structure together and see if you, once you're out of pain, can you be in the church or do you need to leave? It can be a struggle to come to that point. But just don't leave too quickly. I've just watched people do so much better when they've stayed with it and worked through the pain and then decided when they were not in pain than just saying, this is painful, I can't take it, and leave and
mm-hmm,
stop thinking about it, just walk away.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, and like you say, the sabbatical, the stepping away, that certainly happened with Joanna. It happened with me, too. I mean, I would go once a month or whatever. There was a while, 6 months, I went to both Unitarians and the Mormons. You know, whatever it is that you need to regarner your own resources and let your kind of, you know, feed your mind, feed your soul and stuff like that without just getting slapped in the face every second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, good. And I'm glad that you felt supported by the universe as well during this whole process. That was neat when you just kind of said, you know, yeah, it was definitely a wrestle and it wasn't fun, but you kind of knew that you were on a good path.
I did. And it's been worth it. And I'm grateful for the experience that I've had, even the hard ones.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of bring this to a close. Is there anything more about prophets just and revelation that, you know, final thoughts on that, just to kind of, that's ostensibly what we're doing today is here. You know, you had to reframe this. Why are you able to say they're a prophet, or why are you able to, like, handle them as, you know, fully influenced by culture and, culture, et cetera, also, but still allow that there's inspiration, something called prophetic inspiration going on there?
I asked one of my friends one time, how are you able to deal with it? And he said, I had a grandmother who used to say, they're just men. What do you expect? They're just men. Sometimes we put our leaders up on too high of a pedestal and expect too much. They're there to try and provide us with inspiration, provide us with some guidance, but they're not expected to be, they don't claim to be perfect. And sometimes, and part of it is I think our curriculum, it's kind of whitewashed and imperfections out of our stories of our prophets, but they are good people trying hard, trying to provide as much general information to help the body of the church as they can, but I don't see them as perfect. I see them as good people trying hard.
Yeah. Would you, as a primary president, allow follow the prophet, you know, things like that? How would you, is it age and stage appropriate for children to be able to be okay?
That's the way I see it, is let's teach children that we have a prophet, that we respect the prophet, and that's a way of doing it. But as we mature, we have to mature into, and we're teaching children, we're teaching them right and wrong. We're not teaching them ethical dilemmas as
right,
children.
Right.
They're not ready for ethical dilemmas as children. So they will mature into being able to understand that there are moral dilemmas where it's very difficult to choose between honesty and loyalty. And most Americans lean towards honesty over loyalty. But when you're in a country that you can't trust the government, you can trust your family and friends, you have to lean towards loyalty because you don't know how severely the government might punish a minor crime. And so that's a maturing process, to realize that there are variations of times and situations and that's what church leaders have to wrestle with, is how do we influence the body of the church? And they can't be looking at individual situations, they can be looking at groups of types of situations, and how do we address these issues that are going on, or this big group of issues that are going on. So they have to be general in the teachings and prescriptions that they give us.
Yeah. Awesome. You know, it reminds me, when I was at Sunstone, you know, one of my jobs with each magazine issue was to write an editorial. And I don't remember if there was a particular reason to pick this one at the time that I did, but I wrote one called Hints of Pastoring. And basically, it was one of those things where I kind of shared my own experience with church leaders going through my different things and how I had mostly good experiences. Mostly when it was one-on-one, you know, the bishop could understand understand me to some degree, you know, certainly wasn't wrestling with the same things as me, but they still made me feel included, made me feel welcome, et cetera, like this. And I kind of said, you know, compare that to some of the messaging that comes from Salt Lake that, you know, stick with the middle, stick with us, don't go listening to these alternate voices and all that stuff. And you see that at the general level. And I basically was just trying in that editorial to say, you know, guess what? Everybody that's saying that at this general, for the whole body, you know, rally, you know, part of it, you know, when you're at general conference is to rally the center, you know, like you do it.
Right,
you're gonna build up your base, you know, and things like that. And mm-hmm. so those kinds of things that go on there, guess what? Every one of those guys saying it was probably a really good bishop who really could have loved me in my particularity with my struggle and who would have done that. And they were good stake presidents and with the kind of general, more general love. And then they were good mission presidents and they had these personal wrestles. And so when the rhetoric comes from the pulpit, it isn't the same kind of stuff that would come one-on-one in counseling with them. And so that was a big help for me. And so as I honor prophets and things like this, I just go, look at what the heck those guys have to deal with. And I think of the administrative burden, and I just love them, and my heart goes out to them. And part of that burden is, like you say, to shepherd this flock that's so diverse. When Christine Haglund was on the one that we did about ordained women, she says, you know, and we kind of got into that question of shouldn't the prophets lead versus be followers? And she says, you know, I used to, you know, that used to come tripping off her tongue too, but she says, you know, I realize I want my mom to feel at home in this church too. And I want her, you know, the thoughts that she has about herself and her role and how she builds the kingdom, I want her to feel good about those things. And so certainly, you know, she's not saying that her mom would never, you know, move or shift or things like that, but she just felt like, you know, good for the conversation, but, you know, to ordain women the next week wasn't probably the best thing to do. So she was honoring that complexity that you're talking about too, and that's what I do.
And it takes a long time for a body as a whole to shift significantly, and it's a slow process. And those of us that are more progressive find it way too slow for our liking, but it does require the comfort level and worldview of the whole body to begin shifting.
Yeah. Yeah. But until then, you know, if you've done your own spiritual work, if you've got your own connection with God as part of that executive ego, you know, that I own it for myself here, but I've got the trust, and I can handle what God's telling me about my rightness or my wrongness over there. And that, you know, Joanna was so articulate about that. Boyd K. Packer says he didn't want me in the church. I knew that that wasn't the case. And so when we can have that centering thing there, the rest of it can be what it is. And we can have that energy to sort of say, yep, this is not ideal. And what should I do? How do I help fix it myself rather than just being lost in that despair? So that's where I wanted to have us kind of just share today. So, Rhonda, thank you. I think this has been a great discussion. I hope that this will be something that will encourage a few folks out there. And tell us if it does. Tell us if it doesn't. We'll encourage Joanna and Rhonda and me. We'll come to the blog and we'll be able to engage you there as well. But anyway, just our testimonies, but our testimonies of experience, at least as we leave the podcast, of just, there's peace ahead, you know. Oliver Wendell Holmes has that, you know, there's some simplicity on this side of complexity, and there's simplicity on that side of complexity. And he says, for the first one, I won't give anything. I wouldn't give a fig. But for the other one, I'd give everything I have. And, you know, none of us, Joanna or Rhonda or me or, you know, the other people out there who, you know, decided to stay with eyes wide open, none of us are going to say that this complexity isn't still complex, that, or this, we're not going to say that what's on the other side of this, you know, huge shift is always fun. In fact, and thinks in some ways I'm more attuned to pain than ever.
Yes.
I feel it more deeply. I'm more aware of the effects of, you know, things on folks, because I'm hearing more voices. But in some ways, that's sort of the position of God too, you know, the weeping God.
And I think that's part of the benefit of going through difficult times, is it does dramatically enhance our empathy afterwards.
And so it's no fun to feel that pain, but it also means you can feel the joy. And again, you've got that, you know, I'm not one of these guys that I know it's God talking to me, but somehow or other, I just feel an alignment with universal energy. You know what I mean? And I'm fine to personalize that, but just somehow or other, even in that pain, even in that, I'm like, there's this calm, there's this backlighting, there's this, off in the distance, I just know that all is right, all can be right, all works out. That's just kind of what sustains me a little bit through that difficult feeling the pain parts, too. Does that ring any true with you, too?
Yes. And I just want to wrap up by saying thank you for putting this together today. I appreciate your efforts and contributions.
Thank you, Joanna. I'll just say, listeners, please come to the blog, please share your thoughts. Of course, support Mormon Matters, that's always neat, but I won't go hard with a pitch for financial stuff, but I just wanted to share this, and I hope you guys will have received it in the spirit in which we tried to give it today, and I'll just say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.